while watching someone kick a down vest with a pointy-toed boot. Feathers fly, spectators holler, and voila, dead clucker. The fun parts are betting and screaming, and especially arguing the merits of this or that combat fricassee. I was good at this. Nobody spoke English, but that isn't a handicap if you can do a pantomime of Big Bird. After the main event, one of the owners let me hold his champion, another source of amusement to all. Apparently there is a cool way and a nerd way of holding a fighting cock, and I was the worst chicken grasper anyone had ever seen. Franco was hungry again, though we'd eaten enough for six at his uncle's house. I wasn't hungry, but the girl running the roadside food stand was so pretty, I was willing to stand there and eat things for days if that would keep the gleam in her enormous brown eyes. Franco bought a disgusting batoque, which is a fertilized duck egg, in which the duckling has been allowed to grow until it's almost ready to hatch. Then, it's hard-boiled. The result looks like an anti-abortion movie produced by the Duckburg branch of the Right to Life organization. You eat its little feathers, beak and bones and all. It's bar food in the Philippines. I had a bite, and believe me, batok is not going to replace buffalo wings as the USA's favorite happy hour snack anytime soon. Then Franco began poking around in a big stew pot. He asked the girl something in Tagalog, and she said,
"Aso." "Oh, you should have some of this already,"
said Franco, jabbing me in the ribs and barely able to contain himself. However, "aso" happens to be one of the few words I understand in Tagalog. "You have some," I said.
"Oh, no, no, no," said Franco, taking another bite of duck down. "I'm from Manila. I'm a city man, you know. Ha ha ha, you have some."
I gathered dog was a strictly rural delicacy. The pretty girl was looking expectant, however. And I'd already underwritten a political assassination that day, indulged in the vice of gambling, and committed adultery in my heart. It's dark meat, in case you were wondering, and on the fatty side. Considering what a hot, wet dog smells like, dog stew has a surprisingly savory odor. To tell the truth, it tastes pretty good, like oxtail. To be perfectly honest, it's delicious. Anything about this to my golden retriever, and I'll punch her lights out.
"It's supposed to be very warming," said Franco. "Good for love."
Ha ha ha. Maybe. But I wasn't going to be allowed to gold brick in Manila and find out. A whole pile of angry telexes from Rolling Stone were stuffed under my hotel room door. It seemed I'd been in the Philippines for 2 weeks, and hardly anybody was dead. There hadn't even been a coup attempt, practically the only 2 weeks in the Cory regime without one. Tina suggested I do a story about vigilantes. A lot of people with guns were running around unsupervised in the Philippines, and not all of them were opposed to the government. Armed anti-communist citizen posses were the latest fad. It seemed the NPA was not as welcome everywhere as it was in Marlita. The largest of these vigilante groups was called Alsa Masa, which translates as Masses Arise, or Giddy Up Masses, depending on your translator's sense of humor. Alsa Masa was based in Davao City, on the southern island of Mindanao. So I bestirred myself again and flew down there the next day with Kathleen Barnes, an ABC radio reporter. Mindanao is an historical skunk nest of Muslim, communist, and other insurrections. The colonial Spaniards failed to subdue Mindanao, so did the Americans, and ditto the Japanese and Ferdinand Marcos. Vast, impoverished Davao City was the NPA's first urban target. Until a few months ago, they held the place hostage, the only Philippine city they'd ever penetrated in force. But after the Cory election, the Davao slum dwellers went fickle on the communists. Now there are about 1,000 Alsa Masa gunmen running the city, all of them claiming to be former members in good standing of the NPA. Kathleen wanted to interview Colonel Kalida, the cowboy colonel, commanding officer of the Philippine Constabulary in Davao. The Philippine Constabulary is a national military police force with the same equipment and training, or lack thereof, as the regular armed forces. Colonel Kalida, Kathleen said, had been acting as the ninog, or godfather, to the Alsa Masa vigilantes, letting them keep some of their NPA arms and giving them a semi-official status patrolling the city's toughest districts. Camp Leonor, Kalida's HQ, occupied about 10 square blocks in downtown Davao.
It was all peeling paint and sprung screen doors, like the YMCA camps I used to be shipped to in the 50s. Security was everywhere, much of it asleep. Soldiers on duty wandered around in their undershirts, and groups of civilians loitered on the parade ground. A sign in the hall outside Kalida's office read, "Firearms is not the answer. Superior intelligence is." The colonel was powerful-looking, in a short, compressed way, like an attack hamster. He told us that 3,000 NPA members had surrendered to him personally so far. Kalida's office floor was littered with NPA weapons, the worst-looking arms cache I'd ever seen. There were battered Korean War-era Garand rifles, dozens of ancient gangster-style Thompson submachine guns, Philippine-built short arms with single-shot rifle barrels mounted on zip-gun-style pistol grips, a World War II paratrooper's grease gun, a British hand grenade, a USAF smoke bomb, and a rust-crummied model 1894 Winchester lever-action 30-30 left over from American occupation in President McKinley's time. It was death's flea market. Without a Cuba or any other Soviet butt boy to funnel in commie largesse, the NPA are worse armed than an Oklahoma volunteer fire brigade. "Isn't Alsamasa just going to oppress the masses even worse than the NPA did?" said Kathleen, who didn't hit it off with the colonel. "Neat guns," I said. The colonel and I got along fine. I asked him what had made Alsamasa such a pop sensation, besides, that is, his small but august self. Kalida told me the NPA had grown paranoid and had begun to purge its own ranks. It was a tactical error, as the colonel put it. Comrades began turning uncommunist quick. The former guerrillas had led Kalida to the bodies of 17 purge victims. He hoped there might be 100. The colonel took us outside to see burlap bags full of dead people. An enlisted man dumped them on the parade ground. Dirty bones with that particular smell of human morbidity clunked dully on the ill-kempt lawn. A skull rolled across the grass and came to a rest with its idiot eye holes pointed at the sky.
"Later I will get coffins," said the colonel. "I will give them decent burial. This is propaganda."
Kathleen said, "I have reports that the Alsamasa has been extorting money to support itself, intimidating certain groups, especially Chinese businessmen."
"No," said the colonel. "That is black propaganda. We have intelligence officers, and we would know. But some Alsamasa might ask some concerned groups to help. I do not call that extortion."
"What concerned groups?" asked Kathleen.
"Oh," said the colonel, "Chinese businessmen."
Kalida leaned over and spoke confidentially to me.
"We will disarm the Alsamasa, but I have not told them yet. The government will have to give them livelihoods."
Which was, after all, what Commander Melody had said. The poor Cory government is going to have to get itself a tall stack of livelihoods from the World Bank, or wherever they keep those things. I told Kalida about my visit with the NPA, Kathleen gasping at my indiscretion. "A scruffy bunch," I said, "but they seemed like pretty good guys. I gave them money." Which didn't bother Colonel Kalida. He nodded in agreement. That was the decent thing to do.
"Three things are their motives," he said. "First, the importance. Then, the power of the gun. And only a tiny bit of politics. Just the leaders have the politics."
He told me how he had the NPA leaders' radio frequencies. Sometimes he talks to them in the hills.
"I told them, 'Why don't you come down?'" Kalida said. "There are some beautiful girls in the city. But it is against their principles."
The colonel ordered a police officer to take me to see Alsamasa at work. The cop, Nick, was the largest Filipino I'd ever seen, a sort of kitchenette-sized refrigerator Perry. He and I and a very fat driver got in a battered Japanese micro-taxi and drove off, with chassis scraping the mud streets. Nick was 34. He'd been a policeman since he was 16. In a year and a half, he'd be eligible for his pension. His dream was to go to L.A. and be a security guard. All cities have slums, but Davao is slums. Filthy, jumbled hovels spread like an architectural carcinoma along the mud flats of the Davao River. The place grew up during Mindanao's 10-minute logging and copra boom. The poor were drawn from all the dinky, ungroceried hill towns.
Then the jobs and money went away, but the poor remained. Nick took me to a squatter patch called Agdao. It used to be known as Nicaragdao, partly because the NPA ran it, and partly because Filipinos love any bad pun. Agdao was built right in the water, with splintered packing crate catwalks from one stilt shanty to the next. The Davao River, sewer, sink, and the garbage collection service combined, flowed by underneath. On one bit of dry land was Agdao's only solid structure, a tin roof covering a basketball half-court. I was promptly beaten in a game of horse. The tall kids in these precincts of malnutrition are 4 feet 11 inches, but do layups like Air Jordan. If the NBA ever raises hoops to 20 feet, the Chicago Bulls are going to have to take up field hockey. Nick summoned Pepe, who had been a member of an NPA Sparrow Squad assassination team and was now an Alsamasa leader. Pepe was 23, but looked 16. Two of his boys stood by with Thompsons. They looked 12. Nick hovered over Pepe like a large, blowsy, slightly dim guardian angel. Pepe was smiling, cool and self-possessed. Nick told me Pepe had joined the NPA at 17 and worked his way up from gopher to hatchet man to community organizer, the NPA equivalent of Eagle Scout. I asked Pepe why he'd turned against the NPA, and Nick translated a pat little rap about Corey, democracy, reconciliation, and the rights of the people being violated. "Tell him to get real," I said to Nick. Nick gave Pepe a smirk and a nudge.
"No drinking, no going to movies, no girlfriend," said Pepe. "No church," he added as an afterthought. "I've lived here. I was a target of the Sparrows," Nick proudly interjected. "I survived by being security conscious and not committing crimes."
A rare thing for a Filipino policeman. "Ask Pepe," I said, "if he ever tried to kill you when he was a Sparrow." Pepe and the guys with the guns laughed and began talking, all three at once. Nick, a little abashed, translated.
"We didn't try to kill him. We liked him. When he had money, he would buy drinks."
"Pepe," I said, "did the NPA really purge people, kill them because they thought they were spies?"
"Yes, 6 in the sitio. 1 woman, 5 men."
A sitio is about equivalent to a city block.
"Why?"
I asked.
"A little intrigue only."
By now, about 50 adults and every kid in running distance had gathered around us. I addressed the crowd, not hard to do since being a normal-sized American is like standing on a soapbox.
"Alsamasa, okay?" "Yes, yes."
Lots of enthusiastic nods.
"The masses having fear of Alsamasa?"
I said in pidgin with charades. Much laughter.
No.
The little kids pressed in to touch the submachine guns. I asked Pepe what the NPA leadership was like. He said,
"Politics, lawyers, people who get orders from higher up."
They seemed a vague bunch to him. Had he ever met any?
"No."
Was there ever any contact with NPA groups from other areas?
"Only by higher up." "When Pepe was a Sparrow," bragged Nick, "he killed 20, maybe more. 8 military and 12 others, civilian robbers."
"Jeez," I said to Pepe, "doesn't your conscience bother you?"
"The conscience bothered him before," said Nick, "but not since Alsamasa."
"Pepe," I said, "have you gone to church?" He nodded. "Have you gone to confession?" He nodded.
"Well, what in the hell kind of penance do you get for killing 20 people?" "The priest said I must be very sorry and say many Hail Marys."
Back in the only hotel in Davao with running water, Kathleen was taping an interview with a homely, skinny, left-wing nun. The nun possessed that bottomless indignation endemic to ideologues and had worked herself into a real bother about Alsamasa.
"Small kids are given already armalites, and the grenades are like apples."
She was writing a letter to Corey that would expose these things. I decided to hit the bar. Some people are worried about the difference between right and wrong. I'm worried about the difference between wrong and fun. Holding forth in the hotel's dank but flashy cocktail lounge was Nonoy Garcia, once the top Marcos henchman in Davao, and still the very picture of a corrupt Paul.
He was a barrel-chested, barrel-stomached guy with big gestures, but the ability to order drinks all around with one tiny motion of a finger.
"Come," said Nonoy, spotting me for some kind of journalist. "Sit down. Join us."
He and his cronies were discussing bodyguards. In Davao, it's fashionable to have former sparrows for personal protection. These kids, none of them 21, sat in the background, tiny and shy.
"My boy's only 19, and he killed 10 people," said one of the cronies.
"Mine's 18, said another, "and killed a dozen."
That is, the man was saying, a dozen of his own friends and political allies. The more people your sparrow killed, the cooler it is. When I told Nonoy my father had been a CB, he insisted I have dinner with him. The CBs are revered in the Philippines. In more than 400 years of foreign and domestic mismanagement, the CBs seem to have been the only people who ever made anything work. Nonoy took me to a surprisingly clean Japanese restaurant, a sort of miniature Benihana's, as out of place in Davao as a kosher deli in Amman. Four very beautiful young women were waiting for us at the table. We talked about Corey a bit. Nonoy wasn't bitter, but from his own professional point of view, she wasn't much good as a dictator. He thought she should have started some big, symbolic public works projects and made other grand flourishes to get things hopping.
"She has lost the momentum," he said.
Unfortunately, Nonoy probably had a point. What Corey had done so far in the Philippines was magic, but a very mild kind of magic, like pulling a rabbit out of a rabbit hutch. However, a man must be made of sterner stuff than I am to meditate upon the fate of nations with so many pleasures of the flesh at hand. We ate about 10 courses, drank enormously, and went to Davao's only discotheque and danced with the young ladies until an hour that would make the IMF shudder about productivity in the Pacific Rim nations. I wanted to nurse a hangover, but Kathleen wanted to see the war in the countryside. We hired a jeepney and set off for the hills. A military outpost had been overrun 3 days before in Mondug, about 30 kilometers northwest of Davao. The leftist nun had told Kathleen that a pregnant woman was shot in retaliation while innocently washing her clothes in a stream. Mondug was a pretty farm village with a range of hills behind it. We found the outpost on the first of the hills. It was a sloppy cluster of thatch huts and low stone walls with an open-air mess hall occupying the crest of the knoll. The whole affair looked to have been built by hippies, or large ground-nesting birds. Government forces were back in control, the troops in usual Philippine battle dress. Shower flip-flops, Michael Jackson t-shirts, brightly dyed bandanas around their heads, and snips of red cloth tied to their rifles to protect them from bullets. And there was a spit-shined full-bird colonel there, ready with a colorful yarn about the battle. As befits a romantic nation, the Philippines are great romancers. Tales start out at Jack's beanstalk height and get taller with every telling. Giannini, the Black Star photographer, swears he once saw a Manila newspaper story that began, "Miss Carmelita Torres was struck by an automobile on Rizal Boulevard, and three of her legs were broken." The NPA attackers, riding in a stolen jeepney and a commandeered truck and disguised as banana plantation workers, came down the dirt road that runs beside the outpost.
"How many were there?" I asked the colonel.
"Oh, so many," he said. 100.
100? In one jeepney and one truck?
"Well, there were many more out there," said the colonel, waving his hand at the countryside.
The NPA apparently tried to encircle the position by stopping their jeepney at the outpost and sending their truck down the steep road to the base of the hill.
"But," said the colonel, "our unit in patrol in the village spotted this truck already and fired upon the driver of it, causing him to crash dangerously into a house."
The village was half a kilometer away, so this would have taken some good eyesight and better Armalite shooting. Moreover, the battle hadn't started, and there was no reason to shoot at a truck. However, a trail of mashed palm trees did lead straight off the road and into a small house with a large hole in the middle.
"Then what happened?" I said.
"The defenders of our outpost were attacked by surprise from the jeepney and returned fire, surrounded by superior numbers as the NPA shouted, 'You're looking for us? We are here already!' These MPA then, they were pinned down in the sleeping huts, there for a pirate of 40 minutes, after which our soldiers were forced to have decided tactically to retire with one killed and five wounded. But the MPA, they suffered, 20 killed.
I solemnly wrote this all in my notebook. How many NPA bodies have you, actually found?
Two.
I wandered around the outpost, counting bullet holes and expended cartridges. There were no bullet holes at all in the sleeping huts where the NPA was supposedly under fire for 40 minutes, and only a few chips out of the stone wall around the mess tables. This is what I'm pretty sure actually happened. 15 or 25 NPA came down the road, and the hayseed rebel driving the truck lost control on the hill and went off the road. Meanwhile, the remaining dozen NPA, the most a jeepney could hold, rushed the outpost all pumped up and firing their guns in every direction, and probably inflicting their own 2 casualties on themselves. The completely surprised government troops, who were, 5 will get you 10, having a nap, hightailed it into the shrubbery. Then the NPA grabbed some guns. This is what most NPA actions are about. It's called agua armas, a gun grab. So how many guns did the NPA get? I asked the colonel.
2 M60 heavy machine guns, 1 M30 light machine gun, and 4 armalites.
He didn't mind that I hadn't believed a word he said. He could tell I liked a good war story. That was the important thing. Had he heard anything about a pregnant woman being shot? He said it might be true. The day before yesterday, scout rangers, the Philippine equivalent of Green Berets, had come upon a group of NPA, and he'd heard a civilian had been killed. There was a lot of fighting, he said, around Fatima, the next village up the road. Indeed, dozens of refugees were coming from Fatima, their possessions dragging on wooden travois behind the family caribous. But the colonel said he couldn't let us go there. The road might be mined by the NPA. I'd have thought that 20 or 30 2,000-pound water buffaloes would have cleared up the landmine question. Kathleen and I stood in the tanning salon sun with the colonel, considering. Filipinos don't argue, they consider. And after, as it were, a considerable length of time, a truck arrived from the city, carrying rice and canned goods to Fatima. This allowed the colonel to change his mind without losing face. Now it would be okay to go. The food truck would set off any landmines, and we could follow behind it. But first, the soldiers must inspect the truck.
"It's a food blockade," whispered Kathleen.
This seemed to be true. The soldiers said they had to take 7 sacks of rice and 2 dozen cans of peas off the truck so there wouldn't be extra food for the NPA in Fatima. They stacked these by the side of the road, and the truck rumbled away. We started after it in our jeepney.
"Wait, wait," said the soldiers. "Are you going to Fatima? This food was supposed to go there."
And they loaded the rice and peas into our laps. In Fatima, some families were evacuating, some families were not evacuating, and some families weren't sure if they were evacuating or not. They said one army officer had come and told them to stay put, and another army officer had come and told them to move.
"What are you fleeing?" we asked.
They weren't certain.
"Where are you fleeing to?"
They weren't positive. Who's in charge here? Hard to say. Had there been any fighting? Oh yes, there had been a lot of fighting. In Kalawa, the next village up the road. Events move around a lot in the Philippine countryside. Whatever's happening is always happening one village away from where you are.
"No fighting in this district then?" we said.
Well, no. They thought it over. One eager fellow volunteered that the army had looted his house.
"They stole my pants, my scissors, my radio, and my saw," he said.
He was holding a large cross-cut saw in his hand. I stared at the tool.
"Well, they gave the saw back," he said.
We asked if anyone had heard about a pregnant woman being shot. Yes, yes. It was an awful thing, terrible, very bad. They were all sad about it.
"Did you know her?"
No. They'd heard it on the radio. We drove on toward Kalawa. We were in communist-held territory now. We knew that because a large banner across the road said so. The hills were rising into mountains here and covered with balsam trees. When the road crossed the head of a deep ravine, we could see the amber Davao River twisting through rice fields below us like a gold-link bracelet dropped on a putting green. 5 kilometers from Fatima, we came up on a grizzled old man carrying a wooden hoe and leading a caribou. Man and beast could have belonged in any of the past dozen centuries, except the man was wearing flare-leg double-knit slacks and an earth-smeared banlon shirt, as though dressed for some game of peasant golf. When we asked him about the pregnant girl, the old man was matter-of-fact. Yes, 16 rebels had stayed at his house, more in 2 other houses nearby. About 9 o'clock Sunday morning, while the rebels were having breakfast, the scout rangers fired on the houses. One woman with the NPA was killed, hit in the forehead and leg. Yes, she was pregnant. The rebels fired back briefly, but had short arms only. Then they fled. Put a sock in it, buddy, I wanted to say. For all he knew, Kathleen and I were Fawn Hall and Ollie North, Far East Division. But Omerta is not a Philippine concept. The old man wasn't, however, eager to lead us back to his home. He said someone would show us the way in Kalawa, if we wanted. Kalawa looked like every place else in the Philippines, sort of cute, sort of ratty, with Latin stucco false fronts on Southeast Asian thatch and bamboo buildings. The food blockade didn't seem to be working very well here, either. Our driver immediately began loading his jeepney with cheap local produce. The town's largest landowner invited us to lunch. Yep, he said, Kalawa was a red area. The army never came here because people would tell the NPA on them. He laid out an enormous spread. Rice, sardines, pork chops, mangoes, jackfruit, coconut milk, caramel pudding, and 3 kinds of bananas. Great bananas, I said. Not like what we get back in the States.
Yep, we feed those to the caribou, said our host.
I asked him if he'd been bothered by the NPA, and he said of course he had. They'd considered him a rich man. He said he paid the NPA a tax.
Part out of fear, part out of pity. I bargained with them.
How much did they want? I asked.
10,000 pesos a month.
What did you give them?
300.
This is probably one reason the NPA is communist, because they're such lousy businessmen. If I couldn't negotiate a better deal than that while holding somebody at gunpoint, I'd be a goddamned communist too. While we were having lunch, an ambulance and a car from a Davao funeral parlor arrived in town. The pregnant woman's family had come to get her body. A guide was found, and a procession of a dozen people started into the countryside, carrying a stretcher, shovels, and plastic sheets. The parents were about 60, the father stoic, the mother in steady, quiet tears. We walked for an hour, across a banana plantation and up onto grassy slopes. A cousin, a young man in his 20s, told me the dead woman had been married only a year. She was 26 and 6 months pregnant. Her husband was in the NPA, and she was a member of the Urban Poor Coalition in Davao, a pro-NPA group harassed by Alsamasa. She and some 30 other coalition members had fled to Kalawa, where she met with her husband. She hadn't seen him in several months. The cousin told me all this as though politics were something like a flu epidemic or a car wreck. Kathleen and I found the 3 crude plank houses where the NPA had stayed. There were chickens and a puppy in one dooryard and bullet holes in all the buildings, but no humans. Most of the bullets had struck the houses too high to hit anyone. They'd gone through the flimsy constructions, in one side and out the other. But in one house, there was a sleeping pallet in a corner and several bullet holes just where you'd prop a pillow against the wall. Everything in the scene spoke of idiocy. The NPA had 2 or 3 dozen people cooped up and hadn't secured a perimeter. The houses were sited so that 4 or even 3 scout rangers could have surrounded them and forced everyone to surrender, or killed them all. But instead, the scout rangers had obviously stood away and just let blast, not even bothering to aim. They'd killed 1 pregnant girl, and all the rest had escaped in broad daylight. We could see where the NPA group had run across a plowed field. They'd dropped a cheap pistol holster, some propaganda leaflets, and an empty cartridge box. The grave was 100 yards away, marked with a cross of lashed sticks. It was by the side of a path on a high, broad meadow, in a nimbus of hills. The undertaker's men began to dig. The mother yelled, "Where are the masses when we need them? How could they leave her like this?" The undertaker's men dug carefully, holding their shovel blades almost parallel to the ground and tossing aside little scoops of soil. They wore bandanas across their faces, Everyone else breathed through handkerchiefs. The smell was already as strong as a vision. There is no odor like the odor of a dead human. It's a saccharine putrescence, rotting meat and prom corsages, a sweet, gagging stink. It penetrates clothes and skin. No matter how many times you shower, no matter how many times you tell the poor laundry girl at the hotel to take your clothes back and wash them again, the scent returns like a worry or an evil thought. It's not even such a bad smell, no worse than whiskey vomit, but the reek of our own death goes like a shock to some early, unevolved ganglion just at the head of the spine, to the home of all wordless, thoughtless fear. The first part of the body to come unearthed was a knee, swollen black and round as the crown of a hat. When the mother saw this, she screamed and fell, not in a faint, but attacking the ground with her fists and forehead, and screaming something, screaming everything, I guess, there is to scream. It took three of her family to pull her away. They led her into the shade, where she sat splay-legged and cried, open-faced and open-lunged, making a sound I'd never heard from an adult, a rhythmic sobbing, louder than a yell, the sound infants make, meant to wake the world. The undertaker's men kept at their work, clearing the dirt from two bloated sausage arms and from the mound of pregnant belly and then from the face. The features had swollen and begun to liquefy into a wide, smooth, sickening bruise, with the face of a young girl disappearing into slime, beauty, haunting horror. They pulled at her hips, and the body came free, stiff, distended, overripe inside its ghastly skin, hair trailing clots of sod. What ideology has that oozing face for a price? What abstraction is worth that smell? I convinced Kathleen to fly to Negros the next day to visit a sugar planter friend of Tina's family. Maybe there'd be a vast tile-roofed hacienda with servants to bring lots of drinks to banish the memory of that dead girl, and gardens out to the horizon to look at, to make her face go away, and a swimming pool, a huge swimming pool, to splash chlorine up our noses. But no such thing. Instead, we met Ed Alunan, who had given up a singing career in Manila to save his mother's estate from bankruptcy. He lived in a city apartment. The estate, like many of the big landholdings in the Philippines, was just a couple hundred hectares of cane with a peasant village in the middle, where the haciendero families had lived for generations. Ed drove us there in a dented Japanese car. The Alunans were turning over 10% of their land to Corey's land reform program. Each family on the estate would get a garden plot to grow cash crops. Tina told me later that Ed was in trouble with both the left and the right, with the NPA because he was a landowner, and with the landowners because he supported reform.
"He'll get shot already," she said.
Ed had had some difficulty convincing his hacienderos that the garden plots were a good idea. "We don't want our children to be tied to the land," they'd said. "We want them to go to the city. We want them to go to school." Ed was at pains to show them the gardens were an investment, a way to have something of their own so they could pay for their children's schooling. He sent for specialists from the government's land reform ministry. The specialists told the villagers how they could buy the land for a very modest price, with a low-interest government loan that could be paid back over many years and so forth. The villagers listened politely. When the specialists were finished, they asked their audience, "Are there any questions?" "Yes," said the hacienderos. "Does Ed know you're doing this?" Ed had to go back to the estate and explain that he'd invited the government specialists to come. The villagers nodded and listened to the whole land reform proposal again. "Are there any questions?" said Ed. "Yes," said the hacienderos. "Does your mother know you're doing this?" But they'd gotten the idea at last, said Ed. And now they were full of enthusiasm and had all sorts of progressive projects underway.
"Like what?" said Kathleen, looking askance at the estate's primitive houses and boodle of naked children.
"They come and asked if they could decorate the thrashing floor on Saturday nights," said Ed, "and hire a pillow with a cassette deck and get all the other hacienderos in the area to come and dance and buy beer."
So maybe there's hope for the Philippines. I'm sure there is. There has to be hope for people whose first step out of peonage is to start a discotheque. Christmas in El Salvador.
December 1985. This little country had been nothing but in the news since 1979, linchpin of something or other, vital this and that. Every liberal crybaby had been screaming about the death squads. Every conservative bedwetter had been hollering about the communists. For all I could tell, we were going to go to war down there, and I didn't even know what it looked like. I thought El Salvador was a jungle. It isn't. El Salvador has the scenery of Northern California and the climate of Southern California. Plus, and this was a relief, no Californians. My flight came in over the Cordillera that separates El Salvador from Honduras. The mountains were crisp and pointy, like picture book Alps, but forested to the peaks. We flew across a wide, neatly cultivated valley, and then turned east above the spectacular volcanic cones that divide the central valley from beaches as beautiful as any I've ever tried to avoid at Christmas time. The airport was in the coast littoral, among green fields. Tidy lines of palm trees stood along the roads. Where do we get our information about these places? From a president who can't remember which side Iran is on? From news media so busy being terse and fair that the guerrillas might as well be fighting on the Oprah Winfrey show? I want to know what it smells like. Are the girls pretty? Do they have little plastic Santas in the dime stores? You bet they do. Also, sandbagged gun emplacements with red foil Christmas tree silhouettes on the front. I got a taxi into San Salvador. It was a little Toyota station wagon whose driver had filled the rear window with blinking lights, dangling wise men, and Feliz Navidad in glitter letters. The road to town runs 40 kilometers up through the lava soil hills. The sun set with dispatch. The night was warm, but with a dry, cool breeze. People were sitting down to dinner in the thatched houses by the roadside. There was an autumnal back-to-classes college football scent from the burning cane fields. Nothing particularly sinister was on view, unless you count armed men, though every Latin country seems to have plenty of these. In the capital, some of the architecture was a shambles, but not from war, just from the earthquakes that level everything periodically. I expected to see gross, barbaric haciendas owned by the oligarchy, the so-called 14 families who control more than half of El Salvador's industry and agriculture. But San Salvador's richest suburb, Colonia Escalón, looked like the second-string good parts of L.A. It could have been Sherman Oaks with walls around the yards. The wealthiest 20% of the population gobbles up 66.4% of El Salvador's personal income. Maybe this is unfair, but it still didn't look like any oligarch had enough worldly goods to scare Barry Manilow's accountant. Rapacious as they may be, there's only so much to squeeze from a primitive agrarian country smaller than Vermont. Down at the shore, I was shown a beach house being built by some fabulously corrupt general. It wouldn't have passed muster as a garage in Malibu Colony. It was interesting to think about the rich U.S. liberals, the Jane Fondas, the Norman Lears, the Shirley MacLaines, whining about exploitation in Central America while sitting in houses four times as large as any owned by the 14 families. The middle class, usually described as infinitesimal or statistically almost non-existent, appeared to be all over the place, honking their horns in dusty Jap cars and dented mini pickups. At rush hour, San Salvador seemed to be populated not by 1 million people, but by 1 million New York cab drivers, though Salvadorans speak more English than New York cabbies. All of the well-off people and many of the poor have been to the United States. El Salvador is not nearly so filled with litter, filth, and begging as Mexico. The beach town of La Libertad is supposed to have the best surfing east of Waimea Bay. There are some impressive Indian ruins at Tazumal and Chalchuapa. And Taka, the national airline, lost my luggage, just like airlines do in regular vacation spots. I went to get some clothes at a new upscale shopping center. It looked like a mall in Dayton. Because I'm obviously Norte Americano, a half dozen people stopped and introduced themselves. What part of the states was I from? And how is the Ohio State football team doing? It was a handsome crowd. The conquistadors weren't as civilized as our own founding fathers. They fucked the Indians before they killed them. Now everybody in El Salvador is a slight mix, a sort of mestizo light, Iberian of feature, but prettier colored. The women are heartbreaking. The scene at the mall was less exotic than the Cuban parts of Miami, except for one mystifying detail. I could find no jeans shorter than 32 inches. I'm 5'9", a hand taller than most Salvadorans, and my inseam measurement is only 30 inches. A salesgirl borrowed a needle and thread from a sewing shop next door and basted my new trousers at the cash register. This is a country of beautiful eyes and bad pants cuffs. You can go to El Salvador, for the moment at least, and see nothing too dreadful, just some assorted anomalies. The soldiers guarding the highway to the airport were dressed in full camouflage, but also in day-glow orange road crew vests. It must have been tough choosing between guerrilla sniper fire and the way the average Salvadoran drives. But when you pick your hotel, you pick according to the kind of fear you prefer. The Sheraton, outside town on the hip of the San Salvador volcano, houses U.S. military trainers, State Department and CIA types, and oligarchs home on a visit after taking their bank accounts out for air in Miami. Behind the hotel, running down the volcano into town, is one of San Salvador's dozens of slum-filled ravines or barrancas. This one is known locally as Calle Ho Chi Minh, Ho Chi Minh Street. The hotel security guards are probably useless against the left-wing guerrillas who trundle up and down the barranca. And the guards are probably in league with the right-wing death squad boys who hang out at the bar. In January 1981, two U.S. agrarian reform advisors were gunned down in the Sheraton dining room by pistoleros who escaped through the lobby at a slow walk. A month before, a U.S. freelance journalist had been desaparecidoed there. Gossip has it he was in the bar and asked somebody who happened to be an Escuadrón de Muerte member how to get in touch with the guerrillas. The Camino Real, closer to downtown, houses the press. It's a friendlier place, but if you make the mistake of buying the reporters drinks, they'll tell you stories of kidnapping, torture, and assassination that will make your guts run like a whitewater raft trip. In the past 7 years, nearly 20,000 of El Salvador's 5 million people have been murdered by the death squads, and the army and the guerrillas are bidding fair to kill the rest. Something like 50,000 people are dead from the civil war, 500,000 are homeless, and another 500,000 are on the lam in the United States. There's another kind of horror, not as dramatic, but a lot more pervasive. At any given moment, nearly half the Salvadoran workforce is unemployed. And most of those who are employed receive less than the minimum wage, which is pretty minimum. Per capita annual income is $710. The poorer half of the population has a daily calorie intake that is a third less than what the Organization of American States considers healthy. 80% of their children suffer from malnutrition. Much of this poverty is hidden. It's out in the countryside in places ignored by central government since before the Spanish conquest. And the rest is tucked into the barrancas, because rich Salvadorans, unlike the rich in Rio de Janeiro, Caracas, and most of Latin America, have the sense to live on the hillsides and keep the gully bottoms and ravines for the squalor. It's hard to fathom another society, especially a troubled one, hard to figure its contradictions, measure its attitudes, see it in its underpants. I thought I had an insight at the Mercado Central, the market in downtown San Salvador where peasants and artisans bring their goods. It is a massive, newish cement building that looks like a parking garage for trolls. The two floors are low-ceilinged and lit by a desultory scattering of single fluorescent tubes. And the place is packed, a thrashing minnow seine of small, tan people. Coming in from the blinding sunshine, I felt a gestalt hit me, a Jungian race vision. The cruel Papiles and Mayas flaying victims to the sun, strange hairy man horse conquistadors, the forced labor repartimientos, the Inquisition, the Escuadrones de Muerte. The odor of the charnel house struck me full in the face, but actually, I'd walked into a hanging side of beef. The market was a jolly enough place, once I disentangled myself from the cow. The interior was labyrinthed with aisles a foot wide, the floor piled and the ceiling hung with things to eat. There were eggs and 6-foot ziggurats, baskets of live chickens, cheeses like snow tires, peppers in bundles cute as country kitchen wallpaper, and stacks of fruit like Brazilian nightclub dancer hats.
And everywhere were young country girls with breasts as beautiful as little melons and baskets on their heads full of melons as beautiful as little breasts. One stall had trussed-up armadillos in a basket of iguanas, lips sewn shut, foreclaws tied behind their backs, minor death squad victims in the food chain civil war. On the steps down to the street, an old peasant woman squatted with dozens of little handmade clay figurines like creche figures. They were all soldiers. But the one real insight I had at the market was the crowd, not its appearance or its behavior, but its fact. This country is full, stuffed, gorged with people. The next day, I drove into the Central Valley, which is formed by the Lempa River. People were living everywhere. El Salvador has more people per square mile than Haiti, and only 20% of the land would be used by U.S. farmers for anything but dumping wrecked cars. The crowding, like the poverty, is a subtle, bucolic thing. I didn't really understand it until I tried to find a half-private place to take a leak. Anywhere I went, I'd get an audience of little campesinoettes who'd never seen a Norte Americano trouser snake before. I may say none of them looked very impressed. In El Salvador, there are no Ethiopian concentrations of starving masses to advertise for a rock concert, no skeletal infants to act as poster children for the professional lovers of misery. The malnutrition is what's called first degree, which means the kids are 10 to 24% underweight. They're still cute. Small, but cute. Dead sometimes, but cute. This is the kind of nearly invisible poverty that, in fact, most of the world is mired in. It looks quaint from inside a car. What feeds this countryside is not the truck produce I saw in Mercado Central, but labor-intensive cash crops, coffee, sugar, cotton. But to get land for cash crops, landlords have been evicting tenant farmers and squatters and stealing property from the Indians for 100 years. This is the same thing British landlords did to the Irish in the 19th century, and it's had the same lively results. It was the issue of land reform that sparked the current civil war. A semi-progressive military coup in 1979 brought in a government that tried to redistribute the big estates, the fincas, and to raise the agricultural minimum wage. The terrified oligarchs took to using death squads. The leftist advocates of these reforms took to the hills. But the conflict would have been no great shakes if there hadn't been 5 generations of rural grudges and deprivations behind it. And there won't be any tidy resolution, no matter what ideology wins out. About half of El Salvador's people depend on agriculture for their livelihood. To give each of these families 9 hectares, about 20 acres, the minimum acreage needed to support life, even as rural Salvadorans know it, would take 6 times more cropland than the country has. I was traveling with a translator, I'll call him Alberto, a well-educated and strictly non-political young man. "Where does the government get all its soldiers?" I asked Alberto. "Is there a draft?" Alberto looked to be about draft age.
"Oh, yes," he said. "There's a draft. In everyone's identity book, there is a page where it's marked whether you have fulfilled your military obligation. The army often goes to big dances and festivals and such things and surrounds the places. When the young men come out, their identity books are checked. If they have not done their service, they are loaded immediately on buses and taken to the training camp."
"Were you drafted?" I asked.
"Oh, no."
He looked surprised.
"They only do that out in the country."
There were soldiers everywhere along the highway. Some looked professional, others dragged their guns by the barrels like rag dolls. In between the numerous military roadblocks, we saw dozens of burned produce trucks, victims of rebel economic sabotage. The government operates its roadblocks by day, and the guerrillas operate theirs by night so that Salvadorans have 24-hour roadblock service. We drove on north to La Palma, in the mountains, almost to the Honduran frontier. Until recently, this was a rebel stronghold. There were more bullet holes here than any place I've ever seen, more per square foot than in an average Michigan stop sign. One thing about adobe, it takes a bullet hole beautifully. The bullet leaves a nice aureole of missing plaster around the impact point, like in a Sergeant Rock comic, and not like bullet holes usually look, which is as if somebody used a Black & Decker drill. La Palma has no palms. It's too high and cool.
but it has handsome pine trees. To the north is the crest of the mountain range, with cloud-diademed peaks. To the south, all El Salvador is laid out like the land of counterpane. The town itself is the image of that tile-roofed mountain fastness, where we all think we'll spend our meditative years. Or so it seemed, until I stuck my head into the corner cantina. In the El Salvador hinterland, there's nothing to eat but coarse tortillas, bad beans, and worse rice. There's no clean drinking water, and there's no place to shit but the yard. Nothing except the grip of poverty is stronger than the smell. A couple days later, Alberto and I drove west, to the far side of the San Salvador volcano, where the Escuadrones de Muerte dumped their victims. I asked Alberto, just exactly what kind of people do the death squads kill? This had never been clear to me, and the word leftist was no help. Depending on who's talking in Latin America, leftist can mean anyone from Kim Il-sung to George Shultz.
It just started with labor union organizers, said Alberto, and then just sort of expanded.
We talked for a while about politics in the abstract, the only way Alberto would talk about politics. I told him about my own ventures into activist loudmouthing when I was in college.
Oh, you'd be dead, said Alberto,
and he gave me one of those encyclopedic Latin shrugs.
It is an autocratic tradition of government. There is no mechanism for dissent. What else can they do?
The people who perform the actual killings are, as far as I could figure, militia members, low-ranking policemen, and a few plain bully boys. They hang precariously to lower middle-class status, a couple of steps down the social ladder from the students and intellectuals they abduct, a step up from the campesinos they slaughter. The Escuadrones de Muerte are cut from the same cloth as the scared, fanatic lumps who, 25 years ago in our own country, were dynamiting black Sunday schools and burning Freedom Rider buses. In the U.S. today, they're selling God, Guts, and Guns Made America Great bumper stickers at swap meets. In El Salvador, they have more career opportunities. The dumping ground is called El Playón, the Big Beach. The name is a local drollery. El Playón is a huge cinder field deposited by an eruption of the San Salvador volcano. The lava fell in irregular, sharp-edged chunks, brittle and black, and covered hundreds of acres. The flat color absorbs the light. The porous stone absorbs the sound. Nothing grows or lives on El Playón except vultures, which have the same angles and colors as the lava and look like pieces of it made animate with horrid heads and necks. The cinders are piled like sea chop in pointed crests. The wide river sticks frozen in a moment of bad weather. El Playón has been used as a garbage dump for decades and smells no better than it looks. But there's a more viscerally disturbing odor. I walked 50 or 60 feet out into the cinders and saw a pair of skeletons, rib cages intermingled. The skeletons had no skulls or finger bones. This is to prevent identification sometimes. Or sometimes the head goes on somebody's doorstep. Haircut and a manicure, it's called. The bones weren't hard to look at. They were clean from the birds and the sun. Theatrical, really. But walking back to the car, I saw matted clothes by the path, a sport shirt and jeans, teenage clothes, slim fit and narrow in the hips. And then I was sick and shocked. And scared, too. I had to keep myself from running. I got us out of there as fast as I could, and off to look at some dumb Maya pyramid. Alberto said, "The last time I was here, there were bodies in garbage sacks." How can these things happen in a place that looks like Santa Barbara? A place that's just a quick jaunt down the Pan-American Highway? A place that was settled by Christian Europeans a full 95 years before the Massachusetts Bay Colony? A social system, like El Salvador's, is not one on a TV game show. It takes time and effort to create something like this. The first thing the Spanish did when they arrived in the country was fight with each other. Pedro de Alvarado, leading an expedition from Guatemala, met up with Martín de Astete, leading another from Nicaragua, and they blazed away. The native city-states, mostly Papil, cultural kin to the Aztecs, and Maya were already in decline. These city-states were based on a huge underclass of landless serfs, and either the serfs had rebelled or the topsoil had eroded until it couldn't feed them. Whichever, the Papiles and Mayas were in a very modern condition when the Spaniards found them in 1522. Spain, in the early 16th century, was fresh from a messy national unification. The Spanish crown was determined to maintain centralized control over its new American provinces. For more than 300 years, virtually every administrative post above small-town mayor was held by a native Spaniard. Even the Creoles, the locally born people of pure Spanish blood, were not eligible for office, much less the mestizos, or the Indians. So El Salvador, like the rest of Spanish America, arrived at independence with an experienced group of public administrators numbering none. And Simón Bolívar died saying, "America is ungovernable. He who serves a revolution plows the sea." Not that experienced administrators would have necessarily helped. The historian C.H. Herring points out that there are two kinds of colonies. He calls them farm colonies and exploitation colonies. Farm colonies are refuges where pilgrims, Quakers, and other fruitcakes can go chop down trees and stay out of everybody's hair. But exploitation colonies are places for wastrel younger sons and sleazed-out noblemen to get rich on gold or slave labor plantations. Farm colonists are interested in forming their own permanent institutions. Exploitation colonists are interested in getting home and spending their money. For this reason, New England, Canada, Costa Rica, and parts of Argentina are reasonably nice places, while Mississippi, Jamaica, Mexico, and most other sections of our hemisphere are shitholes. El Salvador is a shithole. The 1821 Salvadoran Declaration of Independence reads, in part, "If we do not issue a proclamation for independence, the people themselves might, in fact, do it." The country didn't even know it was independent for a couple of days because independence had been declared up the road in Guatemala. Two political parties promptly emerged: the liberals, or cacos, thieves, and the conservatives, or bacos, drunks. El Salvador's first war was fought with Guatemala a few months after independence. Guatemala wanted El Salvador to join in a union with Mexico, and so did El Salvador, but not on Guatemala's say-so. Since then, El Salvador has been involved in 42 armed conflicts with its neighbors, culminating in a 1969 invasion of Honduras over a soccer match. Changes in government have been frequent and confusing. In 1839, U.S. Envoy John L. Stevens spent 7 months looking for someone to present his credentials to. And the changes in government have rarely meant improvement. From 1931 to 1944, El Salvador had a dictator named General Martinez who, among other things, put colored cellophane over the San Salvador street lamps to cure a smallpox epidemic. Every now and then, things get out of hand. Now, for instance, or in 1932, when a secret communist rebellion screwed up so badly that its schedule appeared in the daily paper. Only some Indians in the western half of the country actually rebelled. In Huehua, they cut the hands off a local policeman and killed the town's richest man, a liberal philanthropist. Then they got drunk. The Air Force arrived 2 days later and bombed the town. Then the army came. Between 8,000 and 10,000 Indians were killed. All the government troops had ammunition for. President of the moment is José Napoleón Duarte, who was installed in 1980 after the military forced out the semi-progressive junta it had installed the year before. Duarte is a moderate, which, in El Salvador, is like being in a game of tag where everyone is it but you. A British pilot working for TACA told me a story about Duarte. The pilot made an unusually hard landing one time when the president was aboard. The plane bounced several times. As Duarte was getting off, the pilot apologized. "Don't worry," said Duarte. "When people see I was on the plane, they'll blame me." Or they'll blame the United States. The pilot and I were having dinner at an outdoor cafe called Chili's. I happened to look up from my food while the pilot was telling his story, and there was a bullet hole in the iron grillwork by my head, right at eye level. The pilot and I were sitting at the same table where four U.S. Embassy Marine guards had been sitting the previous summer when they were shot by guerrillas from the Central American Revolutionary Workers' Party. The rest of the bullet holes had been covered with neat squares of masking tape and painted over. Are these guerrillas, the G's as they're called, the good guys? They make a point, I was told, of not harming the common people, though they got quite a few besides the Marines that night at Chili's. The G's mostly sabotage the economy. I guess this is all right if you're a common person who doesn't need money or food. Also, the guerrillas seem to be better at killing embassy guards and the like than at getting rid of the death squads.